Thanks a lot, Johannes. Thanks for being here. I have to apologize twice before I start. The first thing is that my English has gotten a bit rusty recently, so please forgive me if words don't come easy to me. The second apology has to do with the first one. I'm going to read out a lot of my paper, which has to do with the quality of my English, but has also to do with me being, I just learned that in the front end of the conference, as me being a kind of a German Marxist intellectual, we simply do more writing and reading than talking freely. So please forgive me that I've written it down, but I tried to give you a lot of images to make it easier to follow. And I'm trying not to speak too fast. So let me start with some historical remarks on fetishism as it developed as a concept of sexology. If we think of sexuality strictly in terms of artificiality, that means in the sense of Michel Foucault has taught us to think about it, sexuality as the most culturally regulated, heaviest scientifically studied realm of human behavior. If we think about sexuality in this framework, it seems obvious that technified sex is no more than one variety in the whole range of artificial modes of having sex. Artificial in the sense of trained or drilled body performance of the stages on which sex is practiced, etc. Since the beginning of sexology, which is usually associated with the name of the Viennese criminal psychiatrist Richard von Krafft-Ebing, I think I have an image of him, that's the guy on the left. Since the beginning of sexology with Krafft-Ebing, genital reproductive sex has been considered not only the normal, but the only real mode of sex, whereas other kinds of sexuality were considered more or less perverse. Consequently, cases of fetishism with fur, with hair, leather, with shoes held a rather big range and share in Krafft-Ebing's founding publication, Psychopathologia Sexualis, which was published in 1886. Fetishism figured, besides homosexuality, as a kind of a model perversion for the emerging sexology as a science. Krafft-Ebing's theory of the fetish was strongly influenced by literary works such as the Austrian writers Leopold von Sacher-Masoch's book Venus in Furs from 1870. That's the other guy you can see up there. This book, you might know the Velvet Underground song with the same name, was very influential then for the development of sexuality as a science. But Krafft-Ebing was also much influenced by anthropological concepts of the fetish, where fetish was ascribed to primitive cultures as a kind of surrogate for real or for monotheistic beliefs. So that's the two sources, maybe. Krafft-Ebing's conceptualized fetishism as a surrogate sex for real sexuality. His fetishists, all of them were male, by the way, were nervous characters that were not able to make the right use of their genitals, but instead got enjoyment out of things dead. His concept was later picked up by Sigmund Freud, also a Viennese, I don't know what that tells us, who saw fetish as quite literal surrogates for the mother's missing penis. In his view, women would therefore be natural fetishists and therefore lifetime seekers for a replacement for their missing fellows, whereas fetishist men would be perverse in the sense of a wrong identification with their mothers and their missing penises. Female fetishism was therefore associated with women's general desire to decorate and to robe, to hide their defect by showing off. And now think of the resonance with Marx's concept of commodity as fetish that was published in 1867, the echo that produces with this concept of female fetishism, a kind of natural fetishism that is expressed in going shopping, one might say. Male fetishism, on the other hand, surfaced as an illegitimate affection for a partial object, as an inadequate surrogate for the full love of a woman, with the clear telos of producing children to maintain production. Read with Foucault, it is more than obvious that the so-called fetishist practices recorded by Krafft-Ebing were no expressions of individuals' pathology, but precise answers to the restrictive construction of reproductive genital sex as the only accepted mode in the last 19th century, and to the increasing amount of commodities that leaked into people's everyday lives. We can then consider fetishist practices in general to be rather emancipatory pleas for the idea that all sex is artificial and partial, for the inventiveness of sex and for an understanding of sex as privileged meeting place for humans and humans, but also for humans and non-humans. Fetishism places sexuality on the intersection of our rootedness in our biological wetware, the desire to be touched, not to be alone, and in our personal and collective histories, as it plays with over long time acquired, culturally heavy encoded and embodied imaginaries. But it also releases the potential to project ourselves into a technologically saturated future. It releases our inventiveness and our eminent non-natural side. As technologies don't only moderate our express our relationship to each other, but have profoundly altered our relationships, we can think of things, of technological things, as magical tools to reshape our experiences. Plus, the good news with fetishism then was and still is, we don't have to reproduce ourselves. We are free to make use of our body and of our sexuality for pure pleasure. We don't even have to use it on other humans, or we can produce things that don't resemble us at all. I want to consider now the role of prosthetic technologies in this interplay of recognition of the past and future orientation, and I would like to argue that techno-fetishism is not so interesting because of its futuristic promises of progress of the humankind, but rather because of its ability to reflect on the biopolitical and disciplining effects of naturalized sex and work. I would like to start by showing you an excerpt of Matthew Barney's Cremaster 3, which is a film from 2002. It's a five-part film series, and it receives its name from the Cremaster muscle, whose function it is to raise and lower the scrotum. And it is also considered being central for the anatomical differentiation of the sexes. In his five films, Barney's aesthetic universe evolves in quite a bionic way, I would say. The biological starting point, this Cremaster muscle, is being inserted into narrative frameworks from other realms, such as biography, mythology, or geology. The film cycle is filled with anatomical allusions to the position of the reproductive organs. And Cremaster One presents the most undifferentiated state, and Cremaster 5 the most differentiated state. Cremaster 3, which I will show you, presents us with a lot of images of conflicting teleologies of differentiation, with images of hyperfemininity and hypermasculinity, and it is full of prosthetic devices, and it is full of animals that are used to sound out the borders of humanness. Prostheses are shown extensively at a figurative level, but medical technical materials are also used as a working material. Barney is a sculptor, and he makes use of prosthetic plastics a lot. But it's also an aesthetic principle, which I will talk about later. Thank you. Glass prosthesis, whom you saw, is Amy Mullins, a double amputee who has set Paralympic records in the 100-meter dash and in long jumping. She has worked as a model and an actress and is very active in promoting rights for the disabled in the USA. We saw her as a kind of prosthetically enhanced Cinderella with glass, plexiglass legs, and as a hybrid of cheetah and human, which refers to the name of her running prosthesis. They, the same kind also used by Oscar Pistorius, who caused the IOC so much trouble this year, they are called cheetahs, like the legs of the cheetahs. What we didn't see, but which is also quite prominent in this section, which is called the order, are women's bodies formatted into discipline corals, dressed up like sheep. No electric sheep, though, but sheep. And Matthew Barney, costumized in a weird Irish-looking dress, climbing to take shortcuts on his way up through the Guggenheim Museum. We would later be able to see him in a nurse's dress, wearing glass shoes that renders him androgynous and a look-alike to Amy Mullins. In this sequence, the whole ambivalent program of aesthetic and scientific approaches to the technically altered human body is present, and I find that really fascinating. The exotic fascination with divergent bodies, the sexualized stalking gaze onto alien bodies, the scientific and technological desire to alter and enhance the body's abilities via training or via technological devices. Think of the climbing versus the external technology that is being shown to make the body even fitter to ascent and to advancement, which is allegorized with Barney's climbing up the Guggenheim Museum and echoed in another climbing scene that is shown in the film where he climbs the elevator of the Chrysler Building from the inside. And of course, the whole range of sexual perversions, bestiality, the reification of women bodies as pets, object love, which is heard about the case with the Berlin Wall, but also traditional fetishes, a lot of shoes, a lot of fur, a lot of silk. Speaking of this, I would like to slide in another Cinderella figure, which was mentioned before. It's Barbarella. Barbarella, one of the few explicitly sexually science fiction films. It shows Jane Fonda surrounded by the furry interior of her spaceship, after her famous agravic strip, and just before getting redressed with her armor-like spacesuit, which she, and I think this is a very nice image of this, she doesn't really like to wear, which shows in the picture down there. Prosthetic fetishism in these two examples is quite obviously entangled with a rather male version of objectifying, taking apart, and reassembling the human body. But Cremaster 3 also discusses the prosthetic altering of a genuinely male body in a quite interesting way. I won't show you this scene because it's too long. It's a scene that shows Matthew Barney as the so-called entered apprentice being half-stripped. And in this scene, he has a strangely shaped, half-amputated and half-artificial penis. He's placed on a, I don't know, dentist or gynecologist's chair where he's kind of tortured with braces made from scrap metal that was taken from artfully crashed cars. But the braces are not only torture instruments, instruments and bodily restraints, they enable him. They enable Matthew Barney to deliver teeth through the tube that extends from his anus. He gives birth to a small sculptures shaped as teeth. In this sequence, the close relationship between virility and violence, between potency and potentiality, between bodily restriction and creative production is articulated in quite a straight way. What Barney actually does here is to turn around sexologists' verdict of the fetishist as being unproductive for the societal body into a form-finding program of artistic creation, assembling heterogeneous and highly idiosyncratic objects, mythological, technological, biological, and biographical. The artwork is being deliberately shaped. But still, it is only man that create here, Richard Serra as the architect, you can see him on the left, who is building phallus-like towers all the time, and the entered apprentice, Matthew Barney, that challenges his hubris by experimenting with more feminine form-finding principles. I would like to draw your attention to the stage of this last scene again, the dentist's office, to shed light on the context in which prosthetics as high-tech artifacts were first developed. And I would like to hark back a bit into the history of prosthetics to show how precise this stage is set in Cremaster III. Industrial production of prosthetics started in the USA just after the Civil War. Before that time, prosthetics were individually crafted by blacksmiths, by carpenters, or by manufacturers of instruments. In the 1870s, though, new methods of mass production were developed to respond to the massive need for prosthetics as caused by the war. This is a sketch. Cannot really see it very well. It's a sketch of Marx's prosthetics factory, which kind of engaged in Fordist production of prosthetics at a very, very early stage. So you can see the prosthetics being manufactured on the different levels of this plant. This need was fueled by fears of losing male labor power, which was connected with fear of the destabilization of gender roles. We heard of this connection of destabilization of gender roles and technology yesterday a bit. Prosthetic industry clearly followed a patriotic goal of reassembling the social, a gesture that was literally performed by reassembling the soldier's body with the help of prosthetics, with the goal of putting the male back into labor market and into his family as a breadwinner. These kind of images can be seen everywhere, this gesture of reassembling a normal body at this time. The next technological advancement in prosthetic industry took place during World War I, where the production of prosthetics were enhanced with the principles of Taylorism, or in Europe, the so-called science of work. One of the leading engineers of that time, the German Georg Schlesinger, who was at the same time a factory manager to a gun plant, developed a new principle of interconnection of all parts of prosthetics to the human body. With the help of standardized tools, he wanted to fit the prosthesis to the worker and the worker to his machine. So he was all concentrated on this interconnecting parts that you can see here. With the help of standardization, yes, he wanted to fit the prosthesis to the worker and the worker to his machine. I don't want to go into details here too much, but Schlesinger's idea on the friction-free connection of maimed soldiers to machines were not really successful. Prosthetic technology took a totally different way, not this direct connection of man and machine. But he very successfully developed a powerful manufacturing principle, the standardization of connections with so-called normalcies. His system for the replacement of organs with industrially produced interchangeable spare parts revolutionized prosthetics from the core. It made possible the modular construction of prosthetics, which has since then been applied all over the world. So this is just a sheet out of a recent catalog, where you can order different parts of prosthetics. Saying in the early days of prosthetics of World War I, I want to return to the US context now and draw your attention to a different model of cripple care that was promoted by the famous research couple Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, whom you might know. They're usually known for perfecting Taylor's ideas of scientific management with the help of film-based motion studies. The Gilbreth test persons to test their ability to move and to work. The Gilbreth test persons were set into rasterized spaces to precisely record their movements. And they used this chronophotographic method to really show what the best movement would be. They were put into these rasterized spaces. Their movements were precisely recorded, and then these movements were dissected into what was called cerebliques. These codified basic movements would then be transmitted onto charts again. And here you see what the use of the chart was. It was to have an accurate image of optimal movements. And I brought something else on the left hand. You can't really see it, but it's there. It's on the right hand. You could see a chart of this cerebliques, and on the other side you could see a motion chart of folding a handkerchief. So it was used to quite interesting means. Gilbreth, a bricklayer, contractor, and scientific autodidact, had, surprise, surprise, spent the first years of World War I in Germany to help the German army optimize procedures of war surgery. He was a specialist in war surgery. Then he returned to the U.S. in 1916-17 and together with his wife Lillian became one of the leading voices in cripple care, how it was called then. They developed a rather avant-garde view on what it meant to be a cripple. A quote from one of their pamphlets: "When we come to consider the subjects closely, we see that every one of us is in some way a cripple. We can then think of every member of the community as having been a cripple, as being a cripple, or as a potential cripple." The consequence of their concept of the universal cripple was that they did not put so much effort into the prosthetic repair of the maimed bodies, but to set up adaptable working environments that allowed all the potential cripples that we all are to perform efficiently in their jobs. One of the privileged professions, one in which a technified environment would be especially suitable for adaptations in favor to the cripples, was, in the Gilbreth's view, you guessed it already, the dental hygienist. On this picture, although it's a bit dim, you can see a simulated cripple, see his hand stowed away under the white coat, engaged in cleaning the teeth of a patient for demonstrational reasons. I want to interrupt my little historical digression right here and return to the prosthetic fetish as presented in Matthew Barney's film. It's nearly uncanny how precise Barney's arrangement is in this case. Taylor and Gilbreth's systems were in the beginning of this century subject to harsh criticism by the trade unions. The labor leaders feared, with good cause, the devaluation of skilled labor by the Taylor system and therefore strongly disapproved of the new scientific methods. And now see who is torturing these craftsmen. It's the managers and the planners. Another influential post-World War I image resonates also very strangely with Cremaster III. On the right you can see an image taken from anarchist Ernst Friedrich's popular anti-war pamphlet War to the War from 1924. On the other hand, Barney's figure of the entered apprentice. The shocking photographs of maimed soldiers were back then used as visual arguments against the devastations of the technified war, and facial prostheses were produced to hide the wounds the war had caused to individuals, but also to the power of the Prussian state. For Barney, there doesn't seem to be a cure for injury. Only a provisional silk drapery hides and shows at the same time the open wound. By recounting the historical roots of prosthetics, we can now identify the ingredients of Barney's poetic film machine more precisely. It is a military-industrial research complex that is echoed in these fetishistic images, but it is stripped bare from its promise of a technologically and managerially rationalized bright future. Barney's prosthetic fetishes are either phallic torture instruments used by men on men, and they refer to the violent side of efforts to alter the human body, or, and that seems at least as interesting, they are carefully crafted magical devices that allow transgressions between the animal and the human, men and women, past and future. Instead of following the functional trail of prosthetics as tools for reassembling the social and to secure production and reproduction, Barney installs a polymorphous perverse, that's a term by Freud, a polymorphous perverse universe of artistic production, turning around the normative understanding of fetish as an artificial surrogate for the real sex into a highly elaborate program of artificial restraint as a precondition for creation. Now, what does all that have to do with techno-fetishism, which you might have expected to take place in spaceships and on alien planets rather than in the Guggenheim Museum? First, I would like to argue that the Guggenheim Museum, as is contemporary art, are kind of spaceships themselves. A space set aside from the normality of everyday life, a space where imagination and experiment find a last rescue, maybe. And just remember how well the Guggenheim fit as a futuristic backdrop in Men in Black. Second, I want to argue that science fiction's fascination with technology is thoroughly linked to military research, which was, as I tried to show, also the birthplace of modern prosthetics. The first notion of a cyborg, for example, did not come up in science fiction texts or in Donna Haraway's famous manifesto, but in government research. Government-sponsored research on perceptual and physiological effects of space life on humans. The whole idea of the necessity to enhance human features technologically seems to be deeply rooted in the figure of the armed soldier and his technological dominance over the enemy. Still, I think that science fiction does more than just retell imperialist stories of male domination. For example, I like the ambivalent image of bodily enhancement that is drawn in the X-Men comics and films. As you probably know, X-Men is the story of a bunch of mutants whose genetic otherness is subject to anxiousness in the rest of the society. It is not clear in the whole film whether their mutations are a gift, an enhancement, or a disability that has to be protected. And I especially like the character of Wolverine, who is shown here, who has a mutation. He's healing especially fast, but has also been subject to an involuntary experimental surgery that has left him with his prosthetic devices, his infamous iron claws. They are not a mutation, they are engineering. Technology in science fiction is usually overtly sexualized, phallic forms, leather costumes, etc., although rarely even used for experimental sexual intercourse, which is a shame, I think. And we only saw some very few examples in the last couple of days. But this sheds light on how techno-fetishism as a cultural mechanism works. It is a metaphor for a somehow hidden knowledge about the entangledness of sexual desire for the alien other, for technology and domination. And knowledge that is usually not allowed to surface because it lies at the heart of power structures that combine cultural, economic, and technological superiority and that usually culminate in the demonstration of military power as we experience it like every day. But I don't want to paint an all black picture of the future of techno-fetishism. Actually, I like techno-fetishism. I therefore want to show you an excerpt of Marie Chouinard's recent dance piece named Body Remix, Les Variations Goldberg. The piece examines painstakingly the relationship of prosthetics as extensions of the human body, their limiting and self-restricting effects, as well as their productive and liberating moments. It's two small excerpts. I hope you will enjoy them. What I really like in this piece is a kind of a dialectical mode. It's a choreography that shows the possibilities of artificially extended or willfully limited bodies without forgetting that techniques, be they external to the body or internalized, like dance training, which is nothing else but an internalized technology, are always drawn between pleasure and violence, the desire for a different body, and the limitations of what we have got. it demonstrates very convincingly that we can never subtract power structures, such as gendered ones, from techno-fetishism. All we can do is work with them and through these ambivalences. Unlike the most science fiction films, Chouinard's interest in altering and mastering the features of the human machine is not a superhero-like enhancement of the body with technological gadgets. Sometimes the bodies performing here gain all new features. They are literally levitated, which is, of course, the old dream of the ballet itself. But sometimes they really have to fight against the fortitude, against the agency of the crutches and other orthopedics in use. You can see this in this image. There's one guy that is really enhanced by technology and the woman that really has to fight against her things. And it is not clear who the winner in this fight is. When in the end of this little piece, the apparatuses, as well as one marionette-like dancer, ascend into the theater heaven. And I'm coming to an end now. If you compare these two images of prosthetically altered bodies, on the left, on the right, you can again see Amy Mullins. We get, for me, very persuasive impression of Western approaches to the body as at the same time natural and cultural. On the right, you see Amy Mullins, predator-like, waiting for her dash. Right, on the other side, the dancer that struggles to move with and against his crutches. Right, a ready-to-perform disabled person turned into a technically enhanced athlete. Left, and in terms of his bodily abilities, normal or even ideal body, struggling to make sense of the limitations caused by medical technology. All this is contrasted by a seemingly culture-free body performance of the woman on the very left. I want to argue that in Chouinard's performance, but also in images like those of Amy Mullins, prosthetic fetishes appear as kind of, at the same time, loved and hated boundary objects. They don't represent difference and dominance, but they mark the zones within which norms are being negotiated, installed, and deconstructed all at the same time. I want to end with another nearly allegorical image that I want to contrast with another film still from Cremaster 3. It shows Amy Mullins, again, with definitely over-length boot prostheses, watching Hugh Hare, head of the MIT Media Lab for Biomechatronics, group climb a wall with his high-tech prostheses. The scene took place at the Human 2.1 conference last year at the MIT. The group's research is heavily funded by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. And working at the Media Lab, Hare is greatly inspired by ideas of posthumanism. The symposium was dedicated to a, quote, a new era in human adaptability, an era where technology will merge with our bodies and our minds to forever change our concept of human capability. The conference explicitly wanted to blur the distinction between able-bodied and disabled bodies to promote the benefits of technological enhancement in the realm of prosthetics. The Human 2.0 conference shows precisely what the debate on prosthetic enhancement is actually about the fine line between people's rights to live their difference, to use whatever artificial technological feature they prefer to achieve a good life, good sex, or whatever, and on the other hand, the urge to bring our bodies to an imaginary state of perfection, be it to adapt them to ideals of beauty, be it to the purpose of fitting the body to the machines of production and of deproduction, to the machines of the military or the machines of economy, which its promise of individual and collective advancement. Or going up some walls. As the naive fetishization of a technified future often tends to neglect past and present violence, be it physical or symbolic, I would like to propose not the withdrawal from the field of fetishism, but to work through fetishism's restraints and promises, to regain its inventive, critical, and liberating side, and as important, to regain fetishism's recognition for the multiplicity of pleasures our bodies are capable to, or will be capable to, at some stage. Thank you. Oh, and I have an extra image. concerning the military thing, okay, which we might all know.
Is this actually the same kind of prosthetics that she's using, the sport?
Yes, it's all the same, it's technological same. Brand.
Same brand, yeah. Okay. Good. Any questions?
So over and over, whenever I see artwork that's dealing with fetishism and sexuality, even in general, but specifically, I guess, techno-fetishism, although I have a mediocre understanding of the topic, it seems like the overall tone is one of violence or a, kind of a disturbing darkness rather than an air of pleasure or joy and or pride in the eroticism of objects. So I'm wondering how you feel about that, or whether you have an insight into why it seems that we're in the art world, at least, we're concentrating so much on the darker side of fetishism. Mm.
And we have to add that's Benjamin Cowden who provided us with
this nice prosthetic device here.
This nice prosthetic device that's like outsourcing the fetishism to the machine here.
Yes, I think on the one hand, I really think that art at the moment reacts on this kind of very macho-like, militaristic versions of prosthetics in quite a smart way. So this might be why it is so dark, because it tries to fill a discursive place that is not filled by science fiction, for example, or other popular media. But if I speak personally, I really like the artwork of Matthew Barney because it has both, because the Amy Mullins is really performing as a beautiful, light-headed woman here, and it's not only the dark and violent side. It has something very playful when she goes around with her Cinderella prosthesis, which she obviously even it was even her idea to wear those. It was not Barney's idea, but it was her idea to go on stage with this elevating and really sublime versions of prosthetics. And there's a lot of interesting. She writes very interestingly about her own performance of the body and how she's concerned on a kind of a empowering appearance. This is why she refused to do some of the images Barney wanted to shoot with her. So there was some no's from her side, and she really wanted to highlight the agency of disabled persons and of their enjoyment with their own artificiality, which she often does. She always shows up with this totally freakish and nice-looking prosthetics, like this boot prosthetics, which isn't ashamed at all. So this is why I especially like this piece of work, because it has both in it, and it works through both notions very sincerely, which is also the case with Srinath's piece we didn't really see. There's a lot of really uplifting and even funny parts in it.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And I'm glad you showed that last image because it triggered a memory of an exchange that Vivian Sobchak, who's written quite a bit about science fiction and science fiction and postmodernism, and prostheses, and herself has a prosthesis. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a just fabulous essay responding to Jean Baudrillard's exhortation to us to love our prostheses, you know, celebrate our prostheses. And Vivian Sobchak said, well, that's all very fine and good, and I have a very, you know, nicely functioning prosthetic leg now, but I really would prefer having my leg, you know, and not having lost my leg. And so that picture of George Bush with, you know, the celebrating the great technological advances in prosthetics such that, you know, our war heroes, you know, can have, be better than they were even. You know, it kind of, that picture elides, Vivian Sobchak wanting to remember the leg and remember what it meant to her and to her body and to her life. And she felt that was lost when you celebrated the prostheses too much. So thank you for showing that.
Yeah, and I like this text very much, actually. I think there are two texts by Vivian Sapchek. The one is about her lost leg, and the other one is like a ballet of her dealing with her prosthesis, but also with crutches and of being without them. So I think her work is really very good on that. Yeah. And I mean, speaking of enhancement, maybe this last image I showed is one of the, it's not even a very spectacular one. Of course, the DARPA is at the moment very active in trying to develop prosthetics that can be connected to maimed soldiers' arms and that directly function as guns. So this is one of the research projects at the DARPA at the moment. So this is no joke. They are really now trying to kind of fulfill Schlesinger's project, which I tried to show you, the 1970s type who ran the gun plant and tried to connect soldiers' bodies to machines. Now, there's research still going on that goes in this direction. Yeah. What? 1917 this was.
Hey, over here to the left.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask about the boundaries of the idea of prosthetic that you're using. I'm thinking of like McLuhan's idea that information technology is an extension of the nervous system, or surely we would think of a strap-on dildo as a prosthetic, so it doesn't have the like permanency maybe of these prosthetics.
Mm.
Or even like when she is like the cat figure that's like genetically engineered, like would you think of all those things as prosthetics, cell phones, cars?
I think I'd like to answer by what I was coming from was like more the media technology side of prosthetic, of definitions of prosthetics. So I worked with McLuhan, I worked with Donna Haraway, and more it came, I thought that what I was doing was not right because it's such an extension of a real thing, and in disability studies. And I think it was even Vivian Sopcich who once coined the term metaphoric opportunism for using the metaphor of the prosthesis for like everything that has to do with the enhancement or of the body. So I'm trying to be kind of straight and always use the terms in the context they are there. So at the moment I'm really only working on like a subsclera, like prosthetics that are really produced, but I'm quite, I know that the metaphorical realm of the prosthetics is much bigger, but I try not to touch it because I think that doesn't get me anywhere. It was just like asking the other way around, not where can I use it, but where can I restrain the meaning to a concrete historical situation. So this is how I'm trying to work.
By the way, McLuhan is my favorite Canadian Catholic, by the way.
Hey, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the restraint themes in the Cremaster cycle. Three is the only one I've seen, but the tethering and the bungee cords and all the ropes and stuff just keep showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see those ropes and things functioning in the same way as the prosthetic legs and other body parts? And also, given like the particular structures that he's climbing, like the Guggenheim and the Chrysler Building, and how these are just kind of like symbols of different forms of power, what do you think are like the complications and implications of the climbing and the ropes that keep going on?
Yeah, of course, the ropes are a big thing in all Matthew Barney's work. Maybe I should just remind you of his other big cycle, which is called Drawing Restraint. So I think what he always does is set up experiments, very conscious experiments, where he tries to concentrate on one, for example, one bodily feature, and he really tries to cut out all the rest, and then crafts his form out of the restriction. So I think, yes, this whole dealing with ropes and dandelions, this all ties together with his use of prosthetics as always, at the same time, liberating and restricting tools. And what was the other question? Yes, this climbing up, I think this is a totally interesting thing that he kind of he climbs through modernity in some in some sense, within two very heavy concepts of modernity, like the architectural and the art world as methods to advance in society or something like this. And this is very interestingly fit together with this experiments on non-advancing and non-phallic modes of creation, with this acting in very small rooms where people can't really move and they're really small in there, and from this moment then build methods of creation. So I think that there's a very strong interrelation of those two moments. Yeah. And an alternative way of creating that is not tied into modernity's progressive thinking.
Maybe if there is a last question. Yes, of course.
I'm wondering if you can think of such a thing as a biological prosthetic.
Yes, of course, everybody does at the moment. I mean, tissue engineering is kind of the next step of prosthetics. And it's the dream that if we don't have to use mechanical stuff, the advancement will be more friction-free. So.
Right.
Of course, and the other stuff that is, of course, heavily discussed is this wiring of prosthetic devices with the brain material,
right,
which doesn't work at all. But that's the dream, of course, to have.
They're doing it in University of Pittsburgh has been working on those neural connections,
yeah,
right? Yeah.
They have a lot of problems with that,
yes,
because it's. I think one of the. I talked to a researcher recently who also works on this connection of this on this wiring idea, and he said that the thing that is still a problem is that either the chip or the brain is damaged whenever they
right
interconnect, which is
right
a big problem.
Right.
But of course, there's finding biological prosthesis is the next step and the most logical step, because we don't have the problems anymore with fitting a dead material to living material, which is a core problem.
if we lose a limb and then we regrow it completely, is it a prosthetic?
Good question. I guess so.
How many of you have contact lenses? Just about okay.
Have what?
Good, like contact lenses and stuff, you know, like whatever. Okay, good. I guess, thank you very much, Karin Harasser.